Douglas Mawson had terrible handwriting. He kept diaries all his life, but only those of his Antarctic expeditions that made him famous had been transcribed until, 20 years ago, a team of volunteers at the South Australian Museum began to decipher 96 diaries of his field trips in Australia. Not of the icy deserts down south, but the deserts of Australia, mostly the Flinders Ranges in South Australia. That work, under the direction of Mark Farrow, is almost done. Mark joins me now. Mark, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Now, I've had a bit of experience of deciphering bad handwriting. Tell me, what are the problems with Mawson's?
I think the biggest problem is that he's using not only shorthand, but he's using geological terms that we're not familiar with and sometimes have gone out of fashion. So we relied on a geologist to come in and every week to just check any sort of curious words that we were trying to decipher from Mawson's scrawls.
Is AI going to help us here one day? You know, if you feed in a couple of pages of Mawson and then everything becomes clear.
Or something will come out of it, yes. That's a good question.
I used to dream that, you know, if only the typewriter had been invented in 1812, the work that could have been saved. The diaries are scientific, aren't they? They're not confessional or personal.
They cover the personal insofar as he names usually who's on a particular field trip. He often called them expeditions. He might have details of the food that was bought at the markets before they left. And he'll cover things like mileage, which was for his own purposes, for fuel records, but also allows us to track how far he went in distance.
Food, I suppose, for a man who nearly starved to death in the Antarctic would be a point worth noting.
It would, but it's also interesting that when Mawson wasn't starving in the Antarctic, he was quite caring. He actually showed more of his care in cooking for his colleagues than in other things, and that applied to his students as well. They were given an abundance of food.
Was he the stiff, formal figure that he cut in public?
I think he certainly could be, but descriptions by students such as Reg Sprigg, he says that Mawson became a far more relaxed individual, would dispense with his titles, you know, Sir Douglas Mawson, Professor, this sort of thing, and really was at home amongst his rocks, particularly in the Flinders Ranges.
He went to the Flinders before he went to the Antarctic, didn't he? And there was some sort of connection between the two?
Yes, very much so. So he comes to Adelaide from Sydney University to practice geology, the teaching and training of it at the university in 1905. And within a year or so, we know that he's already out exploring this new environment. And in 1905, he actually heads up to an Ajax mine, as it was called, in the Flinders Ranges with his old professor, Edgeworth David, and an old colleague of his, a young student, Grith Taylor. So that was the beginning, I think, of the Flinders Ranges experience for him.
Because the Flinders Ranges, as I understand it, have this connection to some of the geology of the Antarctic.
Yes, through the Flinders Ranges, continuing eastwards up through almost a Broken Hill where Mawson was also studying for his doctorate, there's extensive sections where you can quite easily read tillite, this crushed rock that's been reformed. And it's characterised as the output of glaciers. So glaciers will come along, you know, incredibly thick and literally level landscapes. And the debris, that crushed rock, is what we now call tillite. And Mawson found an abundance of it. It had been seen before, but what he saw was extensive sheets of what would have been glaciers right through the Australian outback.
And that was a scientific breakthrough.
It was, given the extent. A few years before, they'd first noticed, you know, clear signs of glacial action along the coast. But this far inland, where there was no possibility of a glacier reaching, would have confounded the experts at the time.
The Antarctic diaries have been published. Is it intended to publish the Flinders Ranges diaries? And what do you have to do to take the the sort of field jottings of a great mind and turn them into a book.
You mentioned Mawson's Antarctic Diaries that were edited by the director of the Mawson Institute, Fred Jacker, and his wife, Eleanor. And if you read that book, there's a lengthy introduction which provides a lot of context and explanation. And we would probably have to do something similar, but in a digital age, because the diaries were published in 1988, now we would be thinking more along the lines of probably, you know, a little sort of blurb that you could actually click on and get to a hyperlink that would tell you more about, for instance, you know, the state of knowledge in 1905 in South Australia.
But it sounds as though, it doesn't sound as though it's going to turn out to be a book.
It's unlikely. I mean, it could happen, but these days, you know, the pressure on resources tends to encourage us to go digital rather than hard copy.
Mawson has an interesting publication history, doesn't he? Because he wrote The Home of the Blizzard, which I dug into preparing for this interview. And it's really kind of florid. Let me read a little bit. At times, during the long hours of steady tramping across the trackless snowfields, one's thoughts flow in a clear and limpid stream. The mind is unruffled and composed, and the passion of a great venture springing suddenly before the imagination is sobered by the calmness of pure reason. Now, you're not finding stuff like that in the diaries, are you?
Not at all. And I should qualify what you've just quoted so beautifully. Mawson credits in the preface to The Home of the Blizzard that any literary merit the book may have comes from his editor, Archie MacLean.
Aha!
And Archie was florid in his descriptive verses.
Yes. And, of course, The Home of the Blizzard had that other thing, some of the greatest photography imaginable. Are there photographs in the material of the Flinders Ranges explorations?
Yes, we've accumulated about 2,000 prints, and they're largely taken by Mawson, sometimes his students. And it should be said, Mawson was actually quite a proficient photographer. He photographed the Antarctic on his first expedition in 1907 under Ernest Shackleton, and was considered to be, you know, one of the major photographers on that venture.
So you have the photographs, you have this enormous text. How did you recruit people who were willing to sit there in the South Australian Museum and bang their heads against a wall trying to turn these scribbles into English?
Yes, I don't know how we recruited them, but they sort of materialised in one form or another. And one of my main jobs, I feel, is to find something that will interest my volunteers. And a few of them were already quite involved in making treks around the Flinders Ranges and the South Australian landscape. So I put it to them. I didn't give them a time frame, and we didn't really know how many books there were. We just started at the beginning.
You didn't say there are 96 volumes.
It didn't seem important at the time.
You were a scammer. But something kept them going.
I think they became quite obsessive.
Perhaps that's the answer to all of this work, obsession.
Yes.
Have you made discoveries in the course of this work over, 20 years now, that throw fresh light on the geology, fresh light on the science of Mawson's work?
It's an interesting question. So I'm not a geologist, and that's not my area, but we have collaborated with some geologists, particularly sort of field geologists that also work in the SA government. One in particular, Stephen Hoare, has been doing some extraordinary work using mud maps and photographs. And he's managed to identify, for instance, 106 geological locations that Mawson and his students had visited in the Flinders Ranges. And that would become, it's thought, a sort of 3-day walk, maybe a 4-day walk for those that are slower. But more scientifically, I think that's largely already agreed on. But the most fascinating thing to me is that even, you know, Mawson lived until 1958. And even in that year, it was really only just becoming apparent with the first crossings of Antarctica that the Antarctic was a continent. And they were beginning to try and understand exactly how Australia and Antarctica related in a period before sort of plate tectonics were commonly talked about.
I presume that Mawson was publishing scientific papers about the Flinders that were drawn from the diaries.
Yes, very much so. And for us, it's been invaluable to look at those. And he'll refer to going to a site, often he'll mention the number of times, which gives us a clue, you know, if we're missing a diary or at least a field trip somehow slipped through. His letters to colleagues would also be another source. And, of course, other people's diaries.
Other people, the people who were with him on the expeditions.
Yes, and to some extent the records that have survived at the university's geological department. One of his most important colleagues and someone who's always been, I think, poorly recognised would be Cecil Madigan. And he was also mounting his own expeditions, and at times the two would collaborate.
The last expedition was when?
So the last one in the diaries is really 1953, the year after Mawson had retired. But we know from his wife Paquita's biography of Mawson that he and she continued in the 1950s to head up to the Flinders Ranges, and she'd be left knitting and he would be up...
Looking at rocks,
yeah, clambering around.
So there's unlikely to be any of the students who went with him, because he took students every year, didn't he? And the numbers grew bigger and bigger.
Yes.
They're unlikely, perhaps some have survived, but have you been able to make contact with the children of his students? They might have very valuable material.
We've heard back from a few, and they have sort of told us anecdotes about Mawson. What we'd love, of course, would be diaries. We have, for instance, one. What was unusual at the time were to have female geologists, in training. And one, there was a Barbara Warhurst who was with Mawson and others in 1939 in the Flinders Ranges. And she was actually providing quite a detailed account. And it's interesting how it contrasts to Mawson's. There was a small accident, and Mawson mentions the next day that, you know, they had to just check on someone, and she actually provides details about a little field hospital that was visited and how the patient recovered.
To what extent were these expeditions of Mawson's hoping to find valuable minerals? I mean, was there always at the back of his mind a notion that this could turn, you know, this could become valuable work in that sense?
I would have to say it would be almost, I think, unrealistic to assume that in an area that hadn't really been properly explored geologically, Mawson wouldn't have been aware of the possibilities. His first degree at Sydney University was actually in mining engineering, and he was always, I think, on the lookout and did actually get quite involved in uranium deposits in this region.
But the region includes Broken Hill, so there must always have been this notion that there was an El Dorado there, if only you could turn over the right rock.
Yes, it's a very intriguing thought, isn't it? And again, another obsession for many people.
But did he ever turn over the right rock?
Well, I think in truth, his academic geologist mind was looking for a different rock altogether. You know, if, for instance, an erratic in the wrong place that would provide further clues as to where the geology of the Flinders Ranges had been shaped by the latest glacial, and there were a series of glaciers over a long period of the Earth's history.
So glaciers take a long time, deciphering the diaries takes a long time. How close are you to the end? And are you going to keep this team together to the very end?
Sadly, we lost our first transcriber, a wonderful volunteer called Clive Wilson Roberts. But at the moment, Alan Thomas and Tim Tolley are in robust health and seem particularly determined to continue. I'm not sure what that finished date will look like, because there's always more you can add. There's always more you can find out.
There is always more, but Alan Thomas has a rather personal stake in this, does he not?
He does. And we would also say not only a personal stake, but he's partly to blame.
Oh, yes.
As the descendant, a direct descendant of Douglas Mawson, you know, the bad writing we hand to him and say, you know, transcribe it, please, Alan. And it's his job to come up with a feasible explanation for what the scrawl means.
That's the most beautiful use of blame that I've heard of in a scientific context for some time. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Mark Farrow of the South Australian Museum, who is driving this team of volunteers to finish the long, long work of transcribing the great Douglas Mawson's Australian diaries. This is Late Night Live.